11 till 4 p.m. at the First Congressional Church located in Santa Barbara. The entrance is on the corner of State Street and West Padre Street. This event includes a potluck for which all are invited to participate as we want to break bread together with our listeners. We look forward to meeting each and every one of you in Santa Barbara. Further information can be found at kpfk.org.
Breaking bread with my brother, breaking bread with my sister, breaking bread. Breaking bread with my cousin, breaking bread with my buddies, breaking bread.
This is April Grace, and you and I are listening to KPFK, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, 93.7 FM in San Diego, and 99.5 FM in Ridgecrest and China Lake. Also streaming online at kpfk.org.
This is Feminist Magazine, a weekly radical radio show and podcast produced by a diverse coalition of feminists. And every week we bring you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage. And I'm Lynn Harris-Ballin, your host today, and this is what feminism can sound like.
I am Lisa Detmer. We have two major socialist and socialist feminist victories in the last month. First was the election of socialist feminist Catherine Connolly to be president of Ireland, and the election of Zoran Mamdani for mayor of New York, which was made possible because of the enormous activism by grassroots groups like Indivisible, Jews for Economic Justice, and Drumbeat, a progressive grassroots South Asian group that really turned out the vote for Zoran in the South Asian community in New York City. Today we'll focus on these successes by talking to those activists that make these victories possible. In the second half of the show, I will talk to Simran Thind, a community organizer with the New York City grassroots progressive organization Drumbeats. But first, we will talk to two socialist feminist activists from Ireland to see what radical feminist organizing is happening there and what patriarchal forces they are up against. We will be joined by Camilla Fitzsimmons, who is a longtime socialist feminist and activist and has written two books on feminism in Ireland. And we will talk to Isadora Duran, who is an activist with the ROSA socialist feminist movement. ROSA was established on International Women's Day on March 8, 2013 in Ireland as a feminist, anti-austerity, anti-capitalist group seeking to build the socialist feminist wing of the growing abortion rights movement. Thank you both for joining us, and welcome to Women's Magazine, Camilla Fitzsimmons and Isadora Duran. I'm really so happy to be talking to some fellow radical feminists today. I'm embarrassed to say I didn't know much about Ireland before this show. I mean, I had some familiarity with Ireland's fight against British colonialism. I remember hearing Bernadette Devlin back in the 70s when I was in college speak against occupation of Ireland. And I think many of us have heard of the horrible stories of the Magdalene laundries, also known as the Magdalene asylums, run by the Catholic Church. So when leftist feminist Catherine Connolly was elected president, I felt I needed to learn more about Irish feminism and how Ireland was able to elect a leftist feminist, even though I realized that presidential role is more symbolic. You know, because Ireland has been in the news lately because of your election of Connolly, something that would never happen in the U.S., probably in my lifetime. What is the significance of having this leftist feminist elected president? Does this mean Ireland is already or is going to be moving towards becoming a socialist and feminist country?
I wish. Yeah, well, I can say something quick and then Camilla can jump in, I suppose. I suppose for me, the most significant thing about Catherine Connolly's election is I think her strongest attribute politically is probably her being so staunchly pro-Palestine, especially considering the candidates she was up against, just boring establishment saying the same line the Irish state has been saying for a long time. And I think maybe there is this like misconception about like the Irish government internationally, I think, that maybe the US is affected by that they're just this left-wing, pro-Palestine, like completely liberal government, when In fact, I think the state here has been lagging behind the movement in reality and has been refusing to do any meaningful change when there's so many demands the movement has been arguing for a long time, like stopping trade with Israel, removing an airport here, Shannon, as a US Army base, things like that. So Catherine Connolly's victory was, it was an amazing FU to the government who pretend to be pro-Palestine, you know, and I think also just indicates how strong that sentiment here is in Ireland for something better, really. I thought it was interesting what you said about having little hope in that happening in the US when Zoran Mamdani won the mayoral election there yesterday, which is quite, I thought was quite a similar campaign to Catherine Connolly in many ways. But yeah, I think Connolly's victory, especially given the honestly deranged smear campaign the establishment waged against her, like, you can't imagine the kind of videos, the kind of things they said about her for weeks and weeks, trying to paint her as this like evil communist villain who doesn't want, who wants to abolish private property immediately, you know. It was just completely baseless and actually exposed the state for what they really were, you know. They tried to pretend that she was responsible for the housing crisis here, which is extremely bad. But in hammering that point home so much, they kind of exposed themselves because everyone knows it was them in the first place. But they tried to weaponize her past job representing repossessions in the courts as her being responsible for something that they've orchestrated through their neoliberal policies for years and years, you know. So, yeah, I think her victory is inspiring. It gives hope to leftists, to feminists, to activists everywhere. But you're right, it's a ceremonial role, similar to Mamdani's role in New York. And we have a lot more to fight for. But I'd say let this inspire us to really build a movement for Palestine, for women's rights, trans rights, and against capitalism as a whole, because that's where all these crises come from to begin with.
And Camilla?
Yeah, first of all, thanks very much, Lisa, for taking an interest in Irish feminism and for inviting us to come onto your show. And hello to all your listeners. It's great to be here. One of the things you said in your opening was just not having much of an awareness of Irish feminism. I might just tell you a little bit about that, if that's something that your listeners would be interested in, and really what took us to the point that we're at now. Because I think what a lot of people don't realise about Ireland, you mentioned the fact that we were a British colony. We were actually the longest of all British colonies, longer than any other country. It was still occupied by the United Kingdom. Six counties of Ireland is still occupied by the United Kingdom. But certainly the 26 counties of the south of Ireland have been independent now since the 1920s. But what happened when we overthrew the British state was, in many ways, it was replaced by a very, very deep conservative religious state in the main, because the country was broke and the Catholic Church had money. But also because of very, very strong, you know, deeply conservative religious forces within the Irish political establishment, very similar to, I think, what's playing out in the United States at the moment. So Ireland in the 20th century, where it was very similar to my perception of a lot of what's happening in big parts of the US at the moment, where everybody feels they have to be religious and everybody is involved in a church and all of that sorts of thing would have been the case in Ireland. But really, women's rights in Ireland were suppressed much more than in any other country in Europe, much more than in the UK. We had a marriage bar that lasted longer than in any other country. Marriage bars were really common, we know that. But Ireland's marriage bar was much deeper and longer than anybody else.
Just explain what the marriage bar is.
Essentially, they passed a law in Ireland that women were not allowed to work in the public sector. So there were some exceptions. Teaching was one. But that it was even in limited circumstances. And although it was only the law for public jobs, it was blanketly applied across the whole country. So much so that working class families, where typically, if you look to our neighbours in England, working class women always worked in factories, tobacco factories, in domestic service, in other work. Less so in Ireland. So real poverty in a lot of households that really would have done with a second income, which was the case for a lot of working class families in other countries. And then obviously the other piece of our history, you mentioned the Magdalen laundries. There was 10 Magdalen laundries around Ireland. There was also a network of mother and babies homes where it's estimated anything up to about 100,000. Like, take that number in. Very small country. Some estimates as high as 100,000 women went through mother and baby homes, including my own sister-in-law, went through mother and baby homes. Many of them had their children. They're recent. These things, the last mother and baby home closed in 1996. We only got abortion in Ireland in 2018, and because of feminism. So that's the kind of whistle stop history. I don't know what questions that kind of provokes in you that I can speak more to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I was going to ask about that because you have had a very large recent victory for women when the fight to legalize abortion was won in 2018 and the horrible 1983 Eighth Amendment that made abortion illegal was repealed after years of suffering under that draconian law. Can you talk about that fight and how radical feminists played a part in the appeal and worked with other groups on that fight?
Will I say a little bit about the 83 and then you can speak about the struggle? Would that work, yeah. Isadora?
Yeah, go on.
Because I think sometimes what happened in 83 gets forgotten, which was when Ireland became the first country in the world to introduce a constitutional ban on abortion. So obviously abortion was already illegal in Ireland, but there's a really strong connection between the United States story and what happened in Ireland. The reason we had the constitutional ban introduced was because of Roe v. Wade. Because Roe v. Wade was essentially, as you all know, privacy ruling, which essentially built on an earlier ruling, which said that people were entitled to contraception. It expanded that ruling to say that that included abortion. We had the first step of that in Ireland. So we had a woman called Mary McGee, who passed away only a few days ago, who successfully took the Irish state to court and won the right to contraception within marriage. So it was inevitable that that would be extended to include abortion. And the point I just want to make before I hand over to Isadora is that that constitutional ban was put in place at a time when, for the first time in the history of the Irish state, there were women in government who called themselves feminists, but they chose party over reproductive rights, and they didn't leave the political parties that they were members of that introduced that constitutional ban, despite calling themselves feminists. So for me, that really exposes the difference between the socialist radical feminists that we all are, and the liberal, or I would argue neoliberal feminism that is dominant, and why it's so important that we draw a line in between the two. Ursula von der Leyen would consider herself a feminist. She's no feminist for me.
Isadora, maybe you can talk a little bit about that fight for legalizing abortion.
Well, Camilla is so knowledgeable. She's done so much research and has written a number of books on this. I suppose I come from like a different perspective because I'm a lot younger, and also I haven't written any books on this, but the movement to repeal the Eighth Amendment here in Ireland, which held the right to life of the fetus as equal to the right to life of the mother or person who was pregnant, horrific, archaic, dangerous. That movement was only beginning when I was like in my late teens. And I remember before, when abortion was completely illegal, when the Eighth Amendment was still in place, it was just so normal for all young women and teenagers to have an action plan if they happen to have an unplanned pregnancy. You know, there's this incredible organization called Women on Web who post out abortion pills if you need them. And I remember all of my friends knew about that. So I was always pro-choice. And then I went to college, and that was when the movement really started. And that's when I first heard of Rosa. Rosa was established during that movement about 12 years ago. It was a huge mass movement, all kinds of organizations, all kinds of people who came together to fight for abortion rights, you know. But Rosa was set up as like a distinct socialist feminist wing of that movement. And I remember going to lectures in college and seeing all these Rosa protests and seeing the abortion pill bus. It was this campaign organized by Rosa where basically they booked a bus and traveled all around the country delivering abortion pills to people. They ordered them illegally from Women on Web to the country and they distributed them. And the point of that was to politicize the issue and to show to the government that no matter what, abortions will be happening in this country, no matter what. And if it's illegal, it'll just make them 10 times more dangerous. And of course, that would disproportionately affect working class women way more. So that was when I kind of got into feminism and socialist feminism, radical feminism. And I remember when Savita Halappanavar died, which me and Camilla were just talking about, she was a young woman, early 30s, who died because she was denied a life-saving abortion when she needed one because of the Eighth Amendment. And her death, while completely unjust, and I wish it never happened, it sparked this mass movement that really politicized me to a point that I've never returned from, you know? And I still hear stories about how international that movement was, because as we all know, Irish people travel everywhere. We emigrate a lot. And I remember hearing this story about our Taoiseach at the time was at this ceremonial dinner in Australia, and some Irish people living there broke into the event and like dropped a pile of knickers onto the table to symbolize that this movement wasn't going anywhere, no matter how far away he flew from the country. People needed abortion rights and they needed them now and they couldn't wait. So yeah, eventually we won 12 weeks on request because the government was forced to hold a referendum. They were like slowly, one by one, all the different parties who would have called themselves feminists realized they had no other choice lest they would lose all popular support. So they were forced to do it, and you can't forget that. So now we have 12 weeks on request, which is amazing, and not something I ever envisioned I would have when I was a teenager, now that I'm in my 20s. But there's still things to be fought for. Like, for example, women are still forced to wait 3 days after requesting an abortion, which is very patronizing, very anti-worker. For example, if you work far away from a doctor's, if you can't afford a doctor's, if you're in an abusive relationship, all these things further complicate it and make it more dangerous. And also, if a woman or person has a fetal abnormality, they can only have an abortion after 12 weeks if two doctors can determine the fetus will die within 28 days of birth, which is actually almost impossible to determine. So still hundreds of women are traveling abroad to get abortion. But still, it was a monumentous, historic victory, especially given how much of a pious, in many ways, backwards country Ireland was even just 10, 20 years before, like Camilla spoke about regarding the marriage bar. So yeah, really inspiring time that we still talk about all the time.
Let's talk about the socialist movement in Ireland. And Rosa, I see that you recently had a international conference in Vienna and that you're establishing global feminist connections. And maybe you could talk a little bit more about both the global connections and also your journey. Before you were a feminist, did you accept what was going on? Did you feel like you were oppressed? And now that you have been part of Rosa, how has that changed your life? And how do you see it as spreading throughout Ireland, like as meeting a need for other younger Irish women like yourself?
I'll try to answer the latter, although I have to think quite deeply about that. But in terms of international connections, obviously, capitalism, misogyny, patriarchy, these are global ideas that don't stop at borders, as much as fascists and racists would like to say. So I think it's really important to have international connections. I'd say our most significant connection now is with the Rosa type group in Brazil called Feministas Antirracistas Socialistas, anti-racist feminists, socialist feminists, basically. And they're fighting for abortion rights there, where it's still illegal and very, very hard to procure. So that's one of our most significant connections. But yeah, we had an international conference last year, or I think the year before last, in Vienna, where socialist feminists traveled from all over the world. And it was a really enriching discussion. And we hope to have another one in May of next year. And we call it Bread and Roses, which is like a very old term. I don't know if you've heard of it, but basically it basically means, yeah, it's amazing. Of course, we want bread. We want the basic right to live healthily, to have a roof over our head. But we also deserve roses, too, like to enjoy art, relationships, and all the finer things in life as well. So hopefully we'll have more international guests at that, too. In terms of my own political journey, gosh, I suppose my family are quite left. My dad grew up during like the coup against Allende, who was like a left reformist socialist in Chile. So that really radicalized him. And I always grew up knowing I was a feminist. It was just this instinctive feeling. But I remember being like 12 or 13. I think it was a bit before like the feminist wave of the 2010s, where you got Me Too, Nina Menos, all these amazing feminist movements. But you still hear words being thrown around like feminazi, horrific, and all these different things. But I still had this instinctive feeling that that's what I was, that obviously nothing about your gender or sexuality makes you any lesser to anyone. But I suppose, yeah, getting involved in the repeal movement, learning about socialist feminism, how unfortunately, because sexism, racism, transphobia is so deeply embedded in the system itself, Camilla mentioned all these fake feminists in Parliament, you know, there's only really so much you can achieve with this like girl boss feminism ideology of, you know, getting, you know, more women billionaires, more women CEOs, that kind of thing. So that was like a spark for me. And then, of course, I was very interested in gender-based violence. There's this like meme online where like all women say they had an abusive boyfriend when they were 17. I think it's quite true. So just connecting the dots in that way and realizing how all of our struggles were connected, that you can't be a feminist if you're not pro-Palestine, if you don't care about trans rights, because it's the same forces that are attacking us all and want to keep us all down. And then also learning about like how much capitalism a system relies on the gender division of labor, the underpayment and unpayment of so-called feminized work, whether it's in the home, whether it's care work, education, and how much the system needs these ideas about women being inherently maternal, submissive, men being inherently competitive, macho, all both, and how much it actually needs to perpetuate those ideas to keep things in line. And you're seeing so many attacks now on women's rights, trans rights internationally, because it's this concerted backlash on all of the feminist gains that happened during the 2010s. So yeah, I guess learning about that was what radicalized me, and there's definitely no going back now, I'd say.
Yeah, that's great. Before we get more into the critique of neoliberal feminism, I just want to go a little bit more into socialists and leftists. And you said you came from a leftist family. And I know, Camilla, you are a little bit about this, but traditionally leftists and socialists have relegated feminism to like an epiphenomenon that is not part of the deeper class structure of capitalism, and something that'll be addressed after the socialist revolution. And often women's unpaid labor in the household is unrecognized. What's the relationship between radical feminists in Ireland and the leftists in Ireland in the past and present?
Great question, Lisa. And I think this is one that can sometimes make me unpopular is the wrong expression, but I certainly say some controversial things in left-wing spaces. That most recent book that I wrote, Rethinking Feminism in Ireland, some of this is even drawing from my own experience, but I also spoke to other feminists who had been in revolutionary parties, and sexism was an issue. Definitely my experience in my 20s, I'm 56 now, my experience in my 20s of being in a radical left-wing political organization was definitely of being, you know, sometimes shouted at by older men that I didn't really understand. The class struggle came first, exactly as you have described. And really that continued lack of attention to social reproductive labor is something that I believe the left in Ireland is getting much better at. I think Rosa have been really, really important in that. I think other radical left spaces are also getting the message that we just simply cannot, we have to turn the mirror on ourselves and look at sexism within our own spaces, within our own organizations. As many good socialist women have left some feminist organizations. We had an anarchist organization called RAG, which opened in the 2010s, specifically because of allegations of sexual assault within left-wing spaces. In another jurisdiction, obviously, in England, there was the implosion of one of the main revolutionary parties because of an attempt to deal with a very serious assault internally because of the narrative, which I'm sure we all support, that policing is not the answer. So, but in this particular situation, a young woman brought a very serious allegation, and the attempt to manage that without involving the police resulted in a very, very problematic process. So I think things are improving. I think there are some really good feminists of all genders, but I believe that for people like me, part of my mission and part of the change that I would like to be in the world is to make left-wing spaces better, to improve and to really understand that intersectional dimension in a radical way, not in the performative way that we obviously have to reject, but the essence of intersectionalism as defined by the Black feminists in the United States who first conceived of it is very radical, very, very left-wing, is very socialist oriented. You cannot take class and separate it out from patriarchy. They are simply codependent. And I think I think that message is, I hope, I am so grateful for Rosa, and I'll let Isadora back in, to speak about that. I'm not a member of ROSA. I have been involved in many of their actions, but they really are putting it up to the left to ensure that this notion that women have to wait in line is completely smashed. It's simply not acceptable for the left to hold this line. It's a long way to go yet, I think, but it's certainly something that we can and we can improve on, and we're getting better.
And Isadora, is that something you wanted to talk to? Or
it's such an important question, and Camilla said some really good things there too. It's like there are still so many left organizations, so many socialist organizations, so many organizations that might even still call themselves feminist who have those ideas that, you know, we have to stick to the class issues, the bread and butter issues, the real Marxist issues. And like you said, we'll deal with misogyny after the revolution. It sounds absolutely ridiculous. And there are still many people who are trying to repackage these ideas that have actually been debated in the left for over 100 years by amazing women revolutionaries time and time again. Unfortunately, we have to keep debating them. Like often when I meet young women, young queer people, and I say I'm a socialist feminist, I'm a Marxist, they would hear the word socialist and they'd immediately think this is like a boys club, this is like a reading group, this is an organization that doesn't take safeguarding seriously, which I argue against, obviously. But I think Camilla made a really important point that we're living in an age that is so dark, so dire. Fascism is on the rise everywhere. Misogyny is rising, I think. So no matter how feminist an organization you are in, you're not immune from those ideas either. So it's something that you have to consciously break from every single day. This won't become any less relevant. I think it's becoming all the more relevant as time goes on. And yeah, I guess that point about, like, I guess some of those traditional Marxists would be like, misogyny, racism, transphobia, these issues of oppression, they're used to divide the working class. If we just talk about class unity, if we talk about the housing crisis, if we talk about cost of living, that'll bring people together. Yes, it is used to divide people, but it's also it's absolutely baked into the DNA of this system. Like I explained, when you talk about the gender division of labor and the role of the nuclear family, and you can see that all the more clearly now in how much the far right is honing in on trans rights, honing in on bodily autonomy. The system needs it, and that's why we have to fight back and be undeniably feminist, because that's what actually deepens our socialism, in my opinion.
Yeah, good point. So if you're just tuning in, I'm Lisa Detmer here on Women's Magazine, and we're talking to two socialist feminists from Ireland, Camilla Fitzsimmons and Isadora Duran, about feminism, radical feminism in Ireland. You know, you two bring up a very good point, which is that feminism in the US and Ireland has similar things going on in terms of the Me Too and other things. But you talked about identity politics, and Camilla, you write about this, how identity politics has devolved into what you say now replaces the need for a structural analysis with the concept of an individualist idea of opportunity, and that this is depoliticized, this version, and has been fertile ground for the right to attack identity politics. So we're constantly having to fight between these two sides, the socialists who are not feminists and the neoliberal feminists who are not socialists. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that, Camilla. I think that's here we're kind of in the opposite stance, which is that identity politics is pretty dominant and a class analysis has kind of disappeared thanks to the academy here, although we still have a left. I don't know, and I'd love to know how many members you have in ROSA and how large you think the socialist movement is in Ireland by numbers and power. But if you could just address identity
politics. Yeah, I mean, the first thing I think to say is that it's not dissimilar. It is still minority. I mean, there's lots to say about Catherine Connolly's election. You know, there's many analyses out there. One of the analyses that's out there is that people typically vote left when it's, as Isadora described earlier, kind of a low stakes election, when it's something that people feel is more a symbolic role. People are more inclined to vote left. I think we have to actually argue against that perspective. I think people vote left because people want a better world, because people want more equality, because people are appalled by the racism, transphobia, homophobia that exists. But I think the left in Ireland is still relatively small. If you look at something like, for example, polling around political parties, we do have a Revolutionary Left Alliance. So Rosa is not stemmed from the Socialist Party in Ireland, and many Rosa members are also members of the Socialist Party. So the Socialist Party and another political party called People Before Profit have a united platform, and that typically polls at about 5%. So you're speaking still about very low numbers. Now, they have had elected politicians who have punched above their weight hugely, really influential women, Ruth Coppinger, Breed Smith, other independents, Claire Daly, who have been true socialist feminists who've been in Irish Parliament. And Catherine Connolly would have been one of that ilk. Catherine Connolly was previously in the Labour Party, left the Labour Party for a variety of reasons. They tend to try and frame it as a sort of dispute about being allowed run for the party. But actually, she is on record as describing the Labour Party as something that has lost its soul. And really, her politics has been very much socialist feminist. But it is small. It is still a small number, and we have to be really clear about that.
What's going on, family? From the Bay to LA, my name is Kat Brooks. My show, Law and Disorder, is now on KPFK. Cutting-edge interviews with organizers, culture workers, newsmakers, and freedom fighters, the weekly state terror roundup, resistance in residence with artists using their gifts to change the world, and letters from the inside. That's just a small taste of what this show is about as we seek to expose, agitate, and build. Tune in Monday through Thursday at 8 a.m. on 90.7 or at kpfk.org.
It's one thing to love public radio, but it's a special thing to support it. Consider this. If you've got a car you don't need anymore, or you've got one that is simply too expensive to repair, arrange to donate it to KPFK. It's easy for you, pickup is free, and it could be worth hundreds of dollars in support. Thanks in advance, and here is how to get started. Go to kpfk.org/cars or call 877-573-5288. That is 1-877-KPFK-AUTO. And learn more.
You're listening to Feminist Magazine on KPFK on 90.7 FM and kpfk.org.
I also think we need to be clear about the differences within feminism itself. And we're kind of, I know we're kind of alluding to this, and you've mentioned that notion of neoliberal feminism, but I think it is worth explaining to people that there are two souls in feminism. There are two different types of feminism, because people don't understand that feminism is cool again. You can get your smash the patriarchy keyring, all that sort of stuff. And we really need to just sit with people and encourage people to understand that that neoliberal feminism is much worse, I argue, than the liberal feminism that came before it. It's pro-imperialist, for example. There was a strong anti-war element within so-called second wave, and I've inverted commas here, because obviously the waves analogy is not one that I subscribe to. But used to be at least some sort of anti-violence strand within liberal feminism. There used to be a desire for childcare, for example, within liberal feminism. The neoliberal feminism that dominates in Ireland today is one that's pro-privatization, pro-individualization, pro-military in many respects. Some, you know, people who would call themselves feminists trying to drag Ireland into NATO. So I think the split is within feminism itself first, and we need to be clear about that. And then obviously extend that struggle beyond and really understand that feminism and socialism, as I said earlier, are ultimately connected, that if we want to fight against the horrific racism that we're seeing in Ireland, we have to do that through the lens of feminism. If we want to fight against the horrific transphobia, we have to do that through the lens of feminism, because women do worse in all of these situations. So women are the ones who are doing the most dangerous jobs, like cleaning, for example. Mostly migrant women in Ireland, certainly. Women are the people who are in the most precarious work in childcare, in social care, in healthcare, all of these things. So it is really essential that There's so many practical examples of that connection between capitalism and women's oppression that we just have to continue to highlight them.
Yeah, I would like you to give some, like you wrote in your book, Rethinking Feminism in Ireland, sometimes people miss the fact that this accumulation of wealth for the few is only possible because women and girls continue to pick up the bulk of unpaid domestic and care labor. Maybe you could talk a little bit about how that connection between patriarchy and feminism and how it gets lost in these neoliberal feminists, which, and you talk also about how even the movement, the fight against abortion, got co-opted. It may have started out with a broader feminist, radical feminist critique, but then it gets watered down and co-opted. So can you talk, give two examples of both of those? How is patriarchy essential to capitalism that Marxists need to be aware of? And how do neoliberal feminists water down and ultimately end up supporting capitalism in when they fight together against abortion issues and other issues?
Yeah, sure. I mean, first of all, that connection between patriarchy and capitalism, we do have to go back, and I'll try and be as brief as I can, but we do have to go back to that Eurocentric industrial revolution of the 1800s. Kind of the caveat being the capitalism didn't happen all at once then, as the global north like us to believe that it happened in different ways around the world. But let's focus on the British Industrial Revolution, when land became privatized, when factory owners emerged really for the first time, and when technology had really its first kind of influence in terms of agricultural labor in particular. And it was at that point in time, because, you know, women didn't have access to contraception then particularly either. But it was at that time that this division of labor, which we know patriarchy is much older than capitalism, we know that. But at the point of that division of labor, it became money came into the equation really for the first time. So it became an economic imperative. And obviously Engels, many Marxist feminists have expanded these ideas. But that was really the beginning of the family home as the economic unit. So capitalism needs the family. It needs women doing the bulk of unpaid domestic and care labor for it to survive. You fast forward to today, and certainly women are in the workplace. You asked Isadora earlier about her reasons why she's a feminist. Many of my reasons are the life that my mother lived. She had 10 children. She never worked. She had a very abusive relationship. She had a very difficult time. And that's a lot of my motivation. Men are doing more domestic and care labor. But fundamentally, women are still doing the bulk of that. And what has happened is that this notion of these kind of care chains have emerged around the world. So a white woman like me will hire a migrant or working class woman to come in and pick up some of my domestic and care labor. This might be a woman coming into my home to mind my children, or it might be me dropping my children in a private creche where the employees there are paid less money, you know, have worse contracts than I do. Those women then in turn have to pay other women, sometimes mothers, grandmothers as well, to pick up their domestic and care labor, and so on and so on and so on. And that is how capitalism works. And then obviously there's other connections. There's things like the reliance on the oppression of women in poorer parts of the world in terms of the rag trade and other things. Just in terms of the struggle for abortion rights, I think your analysis there is absolutely correct. There is no doubt but that the struggle for abortion rights in Ireland was absolutely held and moved forward by socialist left-wing feminists for 35 years through civil disobedience, through collective action. You had 65,000 people marching. We're a very small country. 65,000 people marching about 6 months before they called for this referendum. But once they came on board, the neoliberal centre-right governments of Ireland, once they came on board, they absolutely sidelined socialist feminists. They watered down the demands. They promised the sun, moon and stars, and then they didn't deliver on any of it. And just as Isadora has said, we have one of the most conservative abortion laws in Ireland, and the fight continues. What actually Catherine Connolly did, what I think Mandami did in New York, which is, Don't concede. Say, yes, I am a socialist. Yes, I am left wing. Yes, and refuse to apologize. And I think that was what was so refreshing about Catherine Connolly's campaign and why we should actually celebrate it and learn from it in terms of a united left approach. Sorry, I went on a little bit there.
No, let me just follow up on the identity politics critique. And Isadora, I'd love to hear yours too, because I do find young people are captivated by this identity politics and enumerating as many identities as they can. You know, I mentioned Camilla's critique that it has devolved into kind of an individualist versus a structuralist analysis. I'd love to hear your perspective, Isadora, as a younger person, but also a socialist feminist.
Yeah, identity politics, it's an interesting one. Like my instinctive reaction is to embrace that term rather than use it in a negative way, because it's mostly used in a negative way by the right against the left, by the right against some of the most marginalized communities, the trans community, like young trans kids who are being driven to suicide because of the way the world is going, you know? So my view, yes, people's identities are important and we should celebrate our identities. And of course, we're all individuals at the end of the day. And that's what's wonderful about being human, is that we're all different. And from my experiences, like going to feminist protests, all of the most radical young people, unfortunately, like Camilla said, the left is tiny. It's absolutely tiny internationally. And there isn't much of a knowledge, because for younger people, there isn't a reference point for big movements that might have happened last century. They're kind of grappling to figure out where they stand politically and how to frame the kind of oppression they experience every day, all the more so now. But I think the most radicalized people I meet are radicalized on the issues of misogyny, of transphobia, of homophobia. And they're generally open. They're like, yeah, I'm trans and my family have kicked me out and the government is saying I shouldn't exist. I'm trying to understand why this is happening. And then you have like an honest political discussion that, you know, both sides can learn from about like the system needs this. And it's all to do with capitalism and the profit motive and how much the gender binary is ingrained into that. And I think generally people are open to that. And if they're not, they may become more open as things become more desperate, you know? So I would personally embrace identity politics, if you call them that. For me, it's people caring about the issues that are most sharply affecting them now and trying to find a way to contextualize them that like more experienced activists and revolutionaries and researchers can try to do for them. I'd be a lot more worried about young men being radicalized by Andrew Tate. I'd be a lot more worried about the racist riots that are happening in Ireland and Britain right now, you know? That's where I would direct my concern at. But I thought it was an interesting point that I might jump into about like these different stratas of feminism. And I think we have to talk about fake feminism at the moment and how the far right and racists are actually trying to steal our clothes and trying to exploit the emergency that is gender-based violence. It's an absolute emergency and it's getting worse every single day to try and push racism. Similarly, it's being used by transphobes to erase trans people from public life. So I think we should be honest about that and reclaim our movement for ourselves, including all of the issues that radicalize young people, even if they're not ticking every dot and comma of Marxism now. Movements can teach them and us how to make those connections better and more real. So that's my thoughts on identity politics.
Certainly my sense of identity politics and how I see it manifesting in the day to day is, you know, that notion of holding one identity as being the explanation for everything. And I think a good way to show what intersectionalism brings is to say, well, Michelle Obama's experience as a Black woman is very different from the experience of the Black woman that cleans her toilet, and really just trying to bring that out. You know, the wonderful scholar Bell Hooks uses an example of Black identity. She tells a story about giving a keynote address at a conference in Milan and then being strip searched in the airport and that she's out of the country. So it's not to deny, you know, the very particularities of the identities that people hold, and the, you know, trans women being, again, another really good example. But it is to appreciate that the structural forces not only create many of those divisions and identities, but continue to divide and perpetuate them when we ignore those structures. And I do think that identity politics is an attempt to weaken the left. I do think that it is an attempt to split and divide. Just like when I learned about feminism for the first time in the 1990s, I remember being told that there's 10 types of feminism, pick which one you are. And that's why I try and say, no, there's two types. socialist and non-socialist. Let's keep it simple.
So we have to end, but I just want to end with Isadora. Maybe you could talk a little bit about what you're working on or hopeful for the future in terms of Rosa that you think is exciting or you're hopeful about or needs to be addressed.
Yeah, just jumping off what Camilla was talking about, the connections between capitalism, the economic system that we live under, and misogyny, how much it needs misogyny, and the impact of colonialism. The north of Ireland has the second highest levels of gender-based violence, violence against women and queer people in all of the EU, and that's directly linked to its colonial history or present. And you can see that in all of the neo-colonial countries that gender-based violence is a lot more severe. So the links are there and affecting people every single day. The 25th of November is the International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women. Sometimes we say gender-based violence because it's more inclusive of queer and trans people. It's quite a significant day of protest in Latin America, especially where the feminist movement is really strong. But Rosa has been trying to make it a significant day here too. So we hold a protest every year, and this year we're holding one again, and we'll be highlighting all the issues, like the absolute emergency gender-based violence is. We're all touched by it. Domestic abuse, gender violence charities are receiving a record number of calls every year. We're seeing the far right trying to steal our feminist clothes to weaponize this issue, to push racism, when actually they're the ones who are creating the conditions for more gender-based violence with their macho male supremacist ideology, you know. And then something else you want to highlight on that day is Ruth Coppinger, who's a co-founder of Rosa. She's a member of parliament, a TD we call it, socialist feminist, and she has brought forward a bill to outlaw the use of counselling notes, the survivors' counselling notes being used against them in the courts. So basically, we know how misogynistic the courts are, although I understand why someone would need them as well, because it's all part of the process of healing and seeking justice. But one of the most egregious examples of the misogyny that's so deeply rooted in the court system is, in Ireland anyway, the use of a survivor's counselling notes against them to assassinate their character, to discredit them, to find some nugget in their past to insinuate that they're lying, that this is all part of a ruse to increase their popularity in society, to get their abuser's money, you know, all these horrific sexist tropes. It just blows open the entire court system and capitalism as a whole in terms of the misogyny it needs to continue, you know, and how even though women, queer people, people of colour need to rely on the state, understandably, there's no other option, it still oppresses them in many, many ways. So we're fighting for a full ban. That's going to be one of the main points in our protest on the 25th. But of course, we want to fight gender-based violence and all its iterations and build a movement against it. So I guess I'd encourage all the feminists, socialist feminists, activists across America who are listening to organize their own protests on that day too, and make it a big day of action against gender-based violence, against capitalism, and against the far right too.
That was an interview with Irish longtime socialist feminist activist and author Camilla Fitzsimmons, whose books Ireland's Ongoing Fight for Reproductive Justice and her new book Rethinking Feminism in Ireland I highly recommend. And we talked to socialist feminist activist and member of the Irish-founded group Rosa, Isadora Duncan. You can find Rosa online in various social media platforms. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Women's Magazine on KPFA Radio, and I'm Lisa Detmer, and I'm your host today. And now we talk to Simran Thin, who is a community organizer with the New York City progressive grassroots group Drumbeat, which was so instrumental in galvanizing the South Asian vote in New York City for Zoran Mamdani.
My name is Simran Thin, and I am an organizer with Drumbeat. Drumbeats is the electoral wing of our sister organization, Drum. And so we organize working class South Asians and Indo-Caribbeans in New York City around all of the issues that sort of impact our folks. And our electoral organization, Drumbeats, was created to endorse, to support, to have make sure that we actually have candidates that are accountable and listen to the people in our communities who are most impacted by all of the issues that working class immigrant folks face. And so we have endorsed candidates. We have, it's always been a member-led process, and we always look at candidates' histories, records, are they actually willing to co-govern with us and not just seek an endorsement? We have always really put in the groundwork for the candidates that we do endorse and support, because we know that they are in turn also going to co-govern with us.
And tell us, why did you get involved?
So I got involved as someone who grew up working class, really seeing the struggles of family members, friends, my community, and that there oftentimes there wasn't really space in a lot of South Asian diaspora of how we center working class people's struggles. How do we actually organize and base build with working class people? The U.S. not being the strongest and sort of having base building organizations, DRUM has been an organization that has truly taken on base building as a foundation of our work and use that to actually figure out how do we actually build power within our community, build the leadership of the working class, of the lowest tier of the working class within our communities, and then have those people be the people who determine what our lives look like and have them actually take on the leadership of governing, making sure people get the dignity that they deserve.
And you all did amazing work around Zohran Mamdani. I saw that really amazing video on Democracy Now! About you all and about all the aunties involved and young people too. Could you talk a little bit about what you all did for Zohran and the effect it had, and also how you were able to include older South Asians?
We have always been an intergenerational organization. Women have always actually generally led the work in our organization and the different committees that we have, the leadership that they take up, whether that be facilitating meetings, whether that be going out and canvassing, phone banking, going to community events and letting people know about Zohran. Drumbeats, like our volunteers have always, and our members have always been the women who really take up the leadership and forefront. And the aunties that both Zohran talks about and often are the leadership of our organization are people who oftentimes have been marginalized in their homes and their lives by their own family, by their communities. And this is sort of the one space oftentimes for a lot of these women to really step into their leadership and their power. They are the ones who are also going to be benefiting most from a lot of Zohran's policies and platforms. Free buses, universal childcare, rent freeze, affordability. These are all things that the women in our communities really care about, which is why they had really threw down for this campaign, is because even when nobody believed in Zohran last October, and it was just a small room of people when he launched his campaign, it was our aunties who were speaking and they were saying, this is why we believe in this candidate. Even if nobody else believes him, and we know that this is a candidate that will actually fight back against the Democratic establishment and also against the right wing white supremacist sort of forces for policies that will actually support and impact our lives. And they've shown up in so many ways outside of, you know, the general political work that they do. It's also feeding people, making sure that children are taken care of, including children. Also, a lot of like young people have been included in our canvases and work. So yeah, that is like some of the ways that they've like really shown up.
Well, it was so impressive to see these women galvanize young and old. Can you tell us how many people you had involved and what do you think the effect was for Drumbeats on the campaign?
Exact numbers I don't have off the top of my head, but we've definitely had, I will say, probably a vast majority of the people who have really thrown down on this campaign are women. So definitely like over 100 women across 6 different bases that we organize in New York City. And so they were the ones who are really taking lead in a lot of this work. And in terms of like what it means for Drumbeats, we really got to shift our communities. This was a campaign which in a lot of ways was also an experiment for us in figuring out how do we actually move our communities who can often get sucked into right-wing propaganda and move them more left. And figure out a way and like, what is a campaign that can actually move them? And this turned out to be one of those things where it galvanized a lot of people. Like a lot of the policies were very straightforward and really easy to understand for our folks and really spoke to improving the material conditions of people's lives in a real way that didn't feel like, okay, this feels really distant from us and maybe it could happen in 20 years. Like, these are things that are actually possible. And so even like around the energy around Zoran, it even wasn't necessarily around his identity of like, this is a South Asian candidate and that is why we should support him. But there's been plenty of South Asian candidates that have tried to get endorsements from Drumbeats, but they necessarily haven't because their policies haven't aligned or their practices haven't aligned with what we need and to actually fight for the working class within our communities. What we saw from this is we were really able to build out our bases, really able to reach out beyond and influence community leaders, community institutions, and really let them know that we as a working class have the power. We have the ability to shift the tides of huge political establishments if we are able to organize, if we actually can move in a very specific strategic direction.
Talk about the right wing in the South Asian community.
So we actually had a lot of people who were voters that we talked to who are registered Republicans and some not even registered Republicans, but were Democrats who voted for Trump in the election last year and who were super pro Zoran this time. And like, we were actually able to shift them to this because we're like, listen, these are policies that are actually affecting us. The reason why Trump won a lot of our communities over in the election last year was because he was speaking to very directly the experiences that working class people have. We then were able to talk to people, and because the Democratic Party was not able to actually legitimately and tangibly give policies that were going to actually support people's everyday lives, we saw that flip happen in November. And this time around, we had so many people who used to be super pro-Trump say that, oh, we are seeing the horrible things that are happening. We are impacted by SNAP benefits. We are seeing the increases in ICE raids. We are seeing how even citizens and green card holders are being picked up. And now we're seeing what Zoran is offering us and how this actually benefits us. And so that is like a really common thing that we saw. And the biggest thing really was that a lot of how Zoran spoke, a lot of how we were speaking within our own communities is not in a way that is condescending, in a way that was a lot of how the Democratic Party establishment politicians were speaking to our community, talking down to us as if we didn't know what we were actually impacted by and the things that we actually needed. And to come at it with a place of compassion and come out of with a place of like genuine struggle with people, because we did have genuine struggle with a lot of people, and really including them in our volunteers, bringing them in, showing them like, what can it actually look like to create a different reality for us.
I totally agree with you. A lot on the left are very condescending of the people who voted for Trump, thinking that they're stupid or they're dangerous. And I agree with you. I think they're not ideological. They're just being spoken to in a way the Democratic Party hasn't. And I think what you're all have done, Zoran, generally in New York City, is a excellent model for how the left can proceed. And it's very inspiring. And I really hope that we can learn from you all and you all become the vanguard of our movement.
Okay, I want to talk about Ireland. Specifically, I want to talk about the famine, about the fact that there never really was one. There was no famine. See, Irish people were only allowed to eat potatoes. All of the other food, meat, fish, vegetables, were shipped out of the country under armed guard to England while the Irish people starved. And then, in the middle of all this, they gave us money not to teach our children Irish. And so we lost our history. And this is what I think is still hurting we. You see, we're like a child that's been battered, has to drive itself out of its head because it's frightened.
And we're wrapping up another edition of Feminist Magazine. Don't forget, you can find all the links from our program today on our website, feministmagazine.org. Find us on Facebook and sharing behind-the-scenes photos on Instagram. Our programs are archived in the kpfk.org audio archives. You can find our podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Google Play. Thanks for listening.
Support comes from CAP UCLA, presenting Third Coast Percussion and Solar Nader on December 6th at 8 p.m. at the Nimoy.
Third Coast Percussion pays tribute to the late Zakir Hussain with Murmurs in Time, his final commissioned work. The program also includes solo tabla and new works by Jesse Montgomery, Tigran Hamasyan, and Jay Lynn, honoring Hussain's enduring legacy at CAP UCLA. More information and tickets available at cap.ucla.edu and kpfk.org.
ICE is escalating deportation operations.